Lecture 30. Democracy Fails. Oligarchy in Athens.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. The defeat in Sicily had enormous repercussions for Athens, and we're going to cover these in this lecture. First, I'm going to look at the results of Athens's great defeat and how it led to the imposition of oligarchy in 411. Then I'm going to examine Aristophanes' biting comedy Lysistrata, with its plot of the women of Greece going on a sex strike to force the men to end the war. And third and finally, I'm going to discuss the oligarchy of 411 in some detail, its fall and its immediate aftermath. So let's begin with the aftermath of the Sicilian expedition. Thucydides blames Nicias' inactivity, his apathy, and his general bungling for the catastrophe in Sicily. And for once, it's hard to disagree with Thucydides. But we cannot deny credit to Syracuse for destroying so powerful an invader. This wasn't a small contingent of Athenian vessels either. It was almost everything the Athenians could have thrown at the Syracusans. So the Syracusans' defeat of the Athenian fleet was on a par with the Athenians defeating the Persians at Marathon. And think of the flip side of this. How would the Greeks have felt now that the Athenian navy, which had enjoyed this long run of success, had lost? Nevertheless, the Athenians had contributed greatly to their failure. Yes, we can pat the Syracusans on the back, but look at Athens's role in its failure as well. For example, it wasn't the wisest of moves to give command of the first fleet to three men who had such different ideas that they couldn't ever agree on one thing. And two of them, Alcibiades and Nicias, openly hated each other. Nicias also had been against the expedition from the outset, so how much effort was he going to put into it? And he's also into omens and portents. Just imagine if he'd given orders for the fleet to sail rather than be swayed by that lunar eclipse. The Athenians would have made it back home. Nicias is the type who would start to brake half a mile before the green traffic light just in case it changes to yellow in the next 5 minutes. You can entrust a person like that with such a huge undertaking. And it certainly wasn't wise, as events proved, to force Alcibiades off the scene. You know, I tend to think that Alcibiades could have pulled off victory in Sicily. I mean, yes, he's looking out for himself, and he did steer Athens towards involvement in Sicily for his own agenda, for military glory. But there's something about him that makes me think that left to his own devices, he could have done it. He could have pulled it off. Certainly the fleet that the Athenians took with them was more than enough to conquer Sicily. So Alcibiades had ample manpower. And his plan of coaxing Sicilian cities to the Athenian cause was a good one. In fact, so too was Lamachus's idea of hitting the Syracusans before they knew what was happening. But then we have the cautious Nicias. There are the Athenians themselves, or rather the Athenians in the assembly, to blame. Could they really have made the sorts of informed decisions that were necessary to mount and run what turned out to be a long mission, nearly 3 years in effect? Evidently not. Nicias's caution in his speeches of 416 was justified. But the people were too blown away at that time by the rhetoric of Alcibiades to think about what Nicias was really saying. And then when things were going horribly wrong, the assembly voted to send a second fleet out to Sicily, this one under the command of Demosthenes. And let's not forget that the assembly originally found that there was no evidence against Alcibiades for his alleged role in the mutilation of the Hermes and the profanation of the mysteries. But then later it recalled him to stand trial for these, evidently swayed by the rhetoric of his enemies. The Sicilian expedition was not only disastrous for Athens, as we've seen, but also it had grave repercussions. Athens temporarily abolished the payment of tribute by the allies in an effort to prevent any revolts. Presumably, the people expected that when news of the catastrophe reached the allies, they would revolt from the Delian League. Yet, you can count the number of allies that did revolt on one hand. Places like Rhodes, Miletus, Chios, and Ephesus. And these places were encouraged to do so by that renegade Alcibiades. So, if he hadn't been around, perhaps they wouldn't have revolted after all. Again, we can't help but think that despite the Athenian oppression of their allies, that these states were getting enough out of the empire that they didn't want it to collapse. And besides, there was no other state that could take over its headship anyway. With Athens' fleet all but annihilated and tens of thousands of troops dead, the city was on its knees again. This is the same situation as when the plague had struck in 429. But in 413, the Athenians would not have been able to do anything about a widespread allied revolt. They had virtually no fleet left and massive manpower shortages now. But there wasn't this allied revolt. And as I said, the economic upsides of being in the league seemed to outweigh the downsides of Athenian rule. And that's very lucky indeed for Athens. But this is the point where the Spartans could have moved in for the kill. The war would have ended in 412. But for some reason, the Spartans didn't follow up the Athenian disaster in Sicily. And I don't know why. The Athenians are resilient, so the Spartans couldn't have thought that they would just curl up and die. But no matter, the fact that Sparta didn't press home its advantage at this time gave Athens the chance to regroup. Not that the road ahead was going to be an easy one, and it certainly wasn't helped by Alcibiades. I mean, thanks to him, Sparta finally began building a fleet of 100 triremes, and it solicited an alliance with Persia, an alliance that was finalized the following year in 412. Now, Alcibiades' asylum in Sparta proved costly to the Athenians. He'd persuaded the Spartans to make an alliance with Syracuse, as we talked about in the last lecture. And also, in that same year, 413, he'd successfully persuaded the Spartans to establish an enclave on Attic soil. And that's why a Spartan force under King Agis invaded Attica and occupied Decelea, which was about 24 miles or so from Athens, so uncomfortably close to the city itself. Holding Decelea meant that the Spartans didn't need to worry about annual invasions anymore, because they now had a permanent base in Attica. That meant that they could venture out from Decelea at any time of the year. They could devastate the Attic crops, and they could even attack Athens itself. Now, bad enough as these things were, Alcibiades' brokering of negotiations between Sparta and Persia was going to lead to an alliance between these two powers that would be a turning point in the war. In fact, we might argue that it's as big a turning point as the Battle of Salamis was in the Persian Wars. Persian involvement in Greek affairs and the Athenians' need to retain their allies along the coast of Asia Minor are the main reasons why the Athenians cobbled together another fleet. But the base for this new fleet was no longer the Piraeus, the harbour of Athens, but the island of Samos off the coast of Asia Minor. The theatre of war is going to switch to this part of the world now. And it's truly amazing, isn't it, how the causes of the Peloponnesian War occurred in the Greek mainland and Corcyra off the coast, and yet we're now moving to Sicily in the Western Mediterranean and to Asia Minor. We've really spread out in this war, and no one at its beginning would have seen that. Alcibiades, however, wasn't going to be welcome in Sparta much longer. When Agis caught him having sex with his wife, this is not a good thing, Alcibiades was forced to leave and fled to Asia Minor. He was running out of options now, and so he began to plan a recall to Athens. Now, only a change in government could allow him to return. After all, the democracy had wanted to put him on trial, and he had fled while he was being escorted back to Athens for that trial. He evidently couldn't return under a democracy, but a change in government, well, that was a different thing. And so, in the ineptitude of the democracy that led to the Sicilian disaster and Alcibiades' desire to return home, we get the genesis of the oligarchic coup that Athens suffered in 411. Now, for some time, there had been an element in Athenian political life that desired some restrictions on the power of the people. I'm not just talking about the Areopagus here. And that's why in 413, a committee had been set up of 10 men. This committee was called the Probuloi. And they had some sort of decision-making power. We can't say they were oligarchs by any means, and the assembly still met and functioned as before. But the establishment of the Probuloi indicated that even among Athenians, there were some who knew that the democracy wasn't running the war properly. Now, in the same year, in 411, and before the coup, Aristophanes produced his comedy, The Lysistrata. It was in a genre called old comedy that has as its emphasis sexual innuendo and scatological humour. And here I move to the second part of my lecture now about the play and especially how it's an exciting window into what the Athenians were thinking about at this time. Now, the plot of the play is famous. Lysistrata is a well-to-do Athenian lady, and she persuades all the women of Greece, not just the Athenians, but all the women of Greece, to go on a sex strike until the men make peace and so bring the Peloponnesian War to an end. So in other words, all women refuse to have sex with all men until the war comes to an end. Now, the comedy is very funny for obvious reasons, and we don't have time really to go into that in this lecture. You should try and read it for yourselves sometimes. But like all of Aristophanes' plays, it has a serious element to it. Clearly, it's an anti-war play. There's no question about that. But it's echoing popular sentiments in wanting peace to end the war and to help rebuild finances, which have taken a hammering. But it's also possible that this comedy is meant to foreshadow the oligarchy. And what I mean by this is that in the play, Lysistrata and the women barricade themselves on the Acropolis. This is the citadel of Athens, as we know. When the men rush to expel them, Lysistrata is defiant in telling the Probulos, that's the leader of the men, that women can run the state better than men can. After all, says Lysistrata, women run their households efficiently and effectively, and so they could manage the city, the polis, in the same way. in the process, says Lysistrata, the women could weed out corruption in society just as they do when they spin wool. In other words, out of the dirty and entangled state in which they get the wool, it's probably a technical term for wool at this stage, I don't know it, but out of this state, they stretch it out, they spin it, and they produce this beautiful, clean product. So goodness knows what they could achieve if they applied the same, say, methodology to running society. What Lysistrata is saying is that a different regime could run the polis better, given that the democracy has ruined the treasury, that it's depleted Athenian manpower, and that it's been responsible for a disastrous foreign policy. If the play wasn't meant to suggest a change in government, then we have an amazing coincidence given its plot. So in a nutshell then, Lysistrata is simply saying it's time for a change. Imagine if we women took over the polis, we could run it more effectively. We would run it like we would run our homes. And she's also saying about corruption, we could take the dirt that is now Athenian society, that is now the corruption in that society, and we could spin it like we do with wool and produce something that's clean, that's non-corrupt. And it's this change in regime, of course, that the Athenians will experience in a few months' time. Is it a coincidence then that at the heart of this play, at the heart of this anti-war play, is a change in regime? This is really what Lysistrata is advocating, that women are going to run the state, not men. It's also Alcibiades who's at the core of things. Alcibiades was now living with the satrap of Sardis, a man called Tissaphernes. Now, this same Tissaphernes had made an alliance with Sparta sometime before. But Alcibiades now let it be known, in Athens that is, that he could persuade Tissaphernes to ally with the Athenians and to give them money to use against Sparta. Given that the Athenians were financially hard-pressed at this time, this would have been music to their ears. But of course, there was a condition. Alcibiades could only get Tissaphernes on board if Athens was an oligarchy. And then, if he, Alcibiades, were recalled. It's beautiful, isn't it? The Persians favoured oligarchies, you see. And so, if Athens were an oligarchy, the Persians might well come over to the side of the Athenians. They weren't right now because of the direct democracy. Now, Tissaphernes, of course, wouldn't do any of these things that Alcibiades said he would, but by the time the Athenians found this out, it was too late. And so we move to the third and final part of my lecture, the oligarchy of 411. Isn't there a lot going on in this couple of years? In June of 411, an Athenian named Peisander engineered a bloodless coup in Athens, and he did this with the approval of the Assembly, because it was the Assembly that voted to set up a committee of 400 with absolute power to govern Athens. And this oligarchy, which is what it is, this oligarchy is commonly called the rule of the 400. Now, it's hard to believe that the people in the Assembly would do this, that they would vote to do themselves out of a job and establish an oligarchy. This is the same people who stood behind the boule in 508 to expel Cleomenes of Sparta and Isagoras from Athens because they wanted a democracy, remember? It's these same people who supported Ephialtes over Cimon. But we'll see in a couple of minutes' time that the composition of this assembly, the one that voted for the 400, was quite different from the good old days. And this helps us understand why the people abolished themselves, so to speak. There are some affinities with the Solonian constitution here. First, the Committee of 400 echoes the Boule of 400. Then there is the power lying in the hands of the moderates. These would be the hoplite class, as opposed to the mass of the poorer people, who would be the thetes. In fact, the thetes were disfranchised in 411 BC because the 400 instituted a wealth requirement as the basis of citizenship. And we know that only 5,000 Athenians met the requirement for citizenship. The thetes didn't. So we've actually stepped back quite a bit in time, haven't we? What we're looking at now is a return to the time before Ephialtes in 462. It's a return to Cimon's moderate democracy of the 460s, in which the thetes were the rowers in the fleet and they hadn't any real political voice because it was the hoplites, that middle stratum of society, that packed the assemblies and in voting made policy. But in these times, Athens hadn't suffered any catastrophes. And it's this message that the 400 preach. There had been no Sicilian disaster before Ephialtes, but now the times have changed, and so regimes should change. The oligarchs did start out trying to increase Athens's financial reserves, as well as its general well-being. However, it was soon very obvious how much power they had. For example, they abolished state pay. And they also dismissed the boule, though they did pay off its members when they did so. An oligarchy could hardly have a key democratic organ like the boule that met virtually every day functioning at the same time, could it? However, splits soon occurred in the ranks of the oligarchs over policy to Sparta. Some of the oligarchs wanted to send an embassy to Sparta in 411 to discuss a peace settlement, regardless of what the terms imposed on Athens would be. But other oligarchs wanted to attack the Spartans and bring them to battle. So it's a bit like the Nicias versus Alcibiades debate all over again. And as with those two, the splits in the ranks of the oligarchs were irreconcilable, and they began to affect the rule of the 400 detrimentally. Since the 400 had been set up to fix the war, to fix things, what was happening now, given the splits in their ranks, wasn't going to augur well for their continuation in the future. And a bigger problem for the oligarchs was the Athenian fleet now based at Samos. As we've been saying, although political power was now in the hands of the 400 and citizenship was open only to moderates or hoplites, the men stationed with the fleet at Samos were the equivalent of the thetes in the pre-Ephialtic constitution. These men, that's the men with the fleet, would have been against the loss of their political power in 411, despite how, in effect, they had run Athens into the ground. The fact that the assembly so effortlessly consigned itself to the back burner when it created this Council of 400, this that became the rule of the 400 oligarchs, was because so many of the rowers were not in Athens, they're in Samos. In other words, they weren't at the assembly in Athens. And this may well have been another reason to station the fleet at Samos, well away from Athens, so that these men couldn't vote against oligarchy. Now, furious at what the 400 were doing in Athens, the Athenians at Samos decided to elect their own strategoi, and so they flew in the face of the 400. Now, what the Athenians at Samos had done, of course, was essentially reconstitute the assembly. And it's as if there were now two political bodies, the oligarchic 400 at Athens and the unofficial popular assembly at Samos. These men, at Samos that is, were also intent on sailing to Athens to oppose the 400. However, they didn't do this. They were persuaded not to sail to Athens. And guess who persuaded them not to go there? Alcibiades. He's back. Alcibiades had joined the men at Samos some time previously. He'd left Sardis to rendezvous with the fleet at Samos, and in fact, he'd been elected one of its strategoi. Does he ever have an interesting life? But the era of the 400 was fast drawing to an end anyway. When the oligarchs proved to be no different from the democracy in running the war, or rather not running it better, the people in Athens had had enough. The attempt to make peace with Sparta never eventuated, so the 400 had failed there. And to make matters worse, Euboea, that island to the east of Attica, Euboea revolted from the Athenian League. Now, this island was strategically vital to the Athenians. It was vital because of its close proximity to the eastern Attic coastline and the supply route. So the loss of Euboea was something like the final nail in the coffin for the 400. In September of 411, the well-being of Athens, to call it that, passed into the hands of the 5,000. That's those who remained citizens after the 400 had imposed a property qualification. And these 5,000 men would rule Athens until June of 410. So the 400 were in power only a few months. Now the new regime, the 5,000, issued a recall of all exiles. And guess who this included? Alcibiades. Although he didn't actually return to Athens yet. It's this government, it's this rule of 5,000 that Thucydides describes as the best in his opinion. Because as he says, it was a moderate blending of the few and the many. In other words, not direct democracy. But in June of 410, the constitution of the 5,000 came to an end and direct democracy was restored. So by the end of 410, we've got the assembly and the boule up and running again. Pay for political office was reintroduced. The hostile contingent of Athenians that manned the fleet at Samos was appeased. They were happy again. So it looked as if life was returning to normal, whatever that was. But to safeguard democracy in the future, each citizen now swore an oath of loyalty to kill anyone who tried to subvert the constitution. And they were allowed to kill anyone with impunity. The historical reality was very different from the appearance that nothing had happened to the constitution. The situation facing the Athenians was now desperate. They had nothing like the numbers of ships they used to have. Euboea had revolted, and in Athens itself, there was still a feud going on between the remnants of the 400 oligarchs. Again, if Sparta had pressed home its advantage now, the war would have been over for Athens. But again, though, Sparta let another opportunity slip by. And so the Athenians escaped disaster by the skin of their teeth. The Spartan reluctance to move in for the kill is surprising. And again, as in 412, it cannot be properly explained. But it was going to be a costly reluctance for them, because this war is going to continue for another half a dozen years. And during this time, Athens recovered a lot of ground thanks to Alcibiades, who was operating off Asia Minor. For example, in 410, he virtually annihilated the Peloponnesian fleet at the Battle of Cyzicus, killing the Spartan admiral Mindarus and sinking 60 triremes. This victory gave Athens ascendancy in the Aegean again, and Sparta sued for peace. The Athenians were now led by the demagogue Cleophon, a lyre maker, lyre as a musical instrument. And Cleophon refused the Spartan request for peace. and I think he was right to do so. You see, as in 425, the Spartans wanted peace but without terms. That meant that Athens and Sparta would simply revert to a sort of status quo position. And their animosities, as Cleon had seen in 425 when he blocked Spartan overtures for peace then, their animosities would mean that it's only a matter of time before hostilities broke out again. Moreover, the Athenians were intent on recouping their losses in the Aegean and off Asia Minor. And so any peace now would inhibit their chances in those regions. And in fact, over the next couple of years or so, Alcibiades recovers a lot of ground for the Athenians in the Bosporus area, including Chalcedon. So I think Cleophon was right to persuade the Athenians to say no. And here's another example, I think, of a demagogue who was working for Athens's best interests, even if that meant continuing the war now. Also in 410, we see signs of prosperity returning to Athens. The tribute was reintroduced. A building program was begun. This included a new temple to Athena and Erechtheus that stood next to the Parthenon on the Acropolis. This is what becomes known as the Erechtheum. Unfortunately, any victories that the Athenians were enjoying would be short-lived because the end of the war is starting to loom on the horizon. And we're going to sail towards that horizon and examine the final years of the war and Athens's last defeat in our next lecture. Thank you very much.